Hello and welcome to the Motor Racing Passion Podcast. I'm Luke Blattman and I've got Adam Blattman, Daniel Blattman and Brock Schaefer with me as usual. And in today's episode, we're discussing something which to many will be a very unpopular topic, but we like unpopular topics. And I think it's a topic that's worth chatting about. The fact that it's 25 years since the first running of the Australian 1000 Classic. So the Australian 1000 Classic, it was first announced in early 1997 by IMG and a company called Avesco. The race to be contested by V8 supercars on October 19 of 1997 at Mount Panorama over a 1,000-kilometre distance. Avesco was formed in late 1996 to market and run the 5-litre touring car category from 1997 onwards. The three shareholders in the company being TIGA, or the Touring Car Entrance Group of Australia, IMG, which is a sports marketing company, and the Australian Motorsports Commission, which was an arm of CAMS, the Confederation of Australian Motorsport, and the IMG-affiliated Tony Cochran was the one leading the company. Avesco wasn't happy with the deal that the touring car teams got at the Bathurst 1000, an event run since 1963, originally as a 500-mile race until 1973, and sought to negotiate better terms, namely the prize money initially. The Bathurst 1000 was run by a company called Bathurst 1000 Event Management, made up of the ARDC, or the Australian Racing Drivers Club, who had run the event since 1963, Channel 7, who had televised the race since 1963 and had held an official stake since 1988, and the Bathurst City Council. The 5-litre touring cars, to become V8 supercars from 1997, had no ownership stake in the event and no control. The teams were invited to compete each year by the Bathurst 1000 organisers. This seemed to be an issue with the new management, along with the prize money paid, and later the TV rights became the main issue, as V8 Supercars signed a deal with Channel 10 to televise all their races from 1997 onwards, yet the Bathurst 1000 had a TV rights deal with Channel 7 through to 2004. Threats were made by V8 Supercars that they would boycott Bathurst. The Bathurst 1000 organisers wouldn't be dictated to, and said they would run the 34-year-old race to international super touring regulations if V8 supercars didn't want to compete. And there was even a rumour of a rival event for V8 supercars on the same weekend as the Bathurst 1000 in 1997 at the old Adelaide Grand Prix circuit. The elephant in the room was, though, that the V8 supercar teams had sponsorship contracts promising a Bathurst race in 1997, and the new Channel 10 deal included televising a Bathurst race too, which was an odd move from Avesco to sell Bathurst TV rights to an event they had no right to sell TV rights for, but even so, it was thought likely a compromise would be worked out. But in the end, for reasons better left to a future podcast, no compromise could be reached. But Avesco shocked everyone by going to the Bathurst City Council and doing a deal to stage their own Bathurst race, promoted and organised by IMG, for October 19, 1997, 2 weeks after the traditional Bathurst 1000, now to be run to super touring regulations. The new event would be called the Australian 1000 Classic, an event that V8 Supercars and IMG at the time made plainly clear was a completely new event and they weren't trying to pass it off as the Bathurst 1000. This event was effectively created by V8 Supercars for V8 Supercars to satisfy their own needs and run how they wanted it to be run, whereas they had just been invited guests at the traditional Bathurst 1000 in years past. Here's some quotes from the time showing V8 Supercars saying they had started a new event and were knowingly distancing themselves from any association with the existing Bathurst 1000. Firstly, Tony Cochran speaking in mid-1997 in an Auto Action article about their new V8 race at Bathurst already possibly moving to November in 1998 to avoid clashing with the new Gold Coast Indy date, which was moving to mid-October. Cochran said, "We have the stars and cars. We have the same circuit. We have a 1,000-kilometre endurance race. We have a massive television coverage, and we have the hearts and minds of the Australian V8 fan base. What we don't have, because it's our inaugural event, is tradition." Later, he also says to Auto Action, "Tradition, dates, all these things mean shit. What people want is V8s on the mountain. To achieve that, if they have to go to Bathurst on, say, November 2, October's not going to mean one shit to anybody." Now, on the date part, I should point out that the date doesn't really play a part in any of this argument, as you really can't control dates. Just look at 2020. the whole argument of this podcast is based around organisation and the fact that the V8 race was organised as a separate competing event. More quotes, this time from the then Avesco chairman, Ron Meacham, who also in 1997, in mid-1997, responding to a Channel 7 legal letter sent out to Avesco and the media about erroneous press reports claiming the V8 supercar race was the Bathurst 1000 and the Great Race. Meacham said about the legal letter, "That's fine. We have no problem with that. We're not talking about the Bathurst 1000. We're talking about the Australian 1000 Classic, our race on October 19. What they talk about is their business." And Channel 10's Lee Diffie said this on a news story in 1999 about the demise of the traditional Bathurst 1000. He said, "It's part of Australian motor racing history, the Bathurst 1000, run over the last 2 years for 2 litre cars." This was a bit weird in itself that Channel 10 took this line for the story, given they quoted Bathurst 1000 stats galore through their 1997 and 1998 telecasts. Tony Cochrane also in 1999 on Channel 10's RPM program, talking in a story about the end of the Bathurst 1000, said about the initial split from the original race in 1996. He said, "We moved on. We created our own Bathurst race. We left them to their Bathurst race. We didn't try and take their date off them. We got on with our own business." And Jeff Jones from IMG in 1999, during the same RPM story, said, "We certainly feel with the FIA 1000, we're developing our own traditions and we're going to further enhance and develop those traditions this year." So it's pretty clear from those quotes that in the early years, the key figures in the V8 fraternity were acknowledging publicly at least that the V8 race was a new and separate event. Obviously, the narrative has changed over the years, particularly after the original Bathurst 1000 died off, while this new event carried on. And these days, the V8 1000 claims all the history of the traditional event back to 1963. Supercar's own YouTube page has the full 1997 V8 Bathurst race up, calling it in the title the Bathurst 1000, though it also calls it Race 31 of the 1997 ATCC in the title, which is incorrect on more than just one level. So it's not just Bathurst history they're trying to reinvent, it seems. And a Supercars journalist also wrote on supercars.com in early 2021 in an article about the history of the ATCC and Supercars Championship sprint races at Bathurst. Quote, "The infamous split of 1997 saw the Bathurst sprint round benched in 1997, with the unified Bathurst 1000 becoming the sole Mount Panorama visit from 1999 onwards." Now, I'm not sure what was meant by unified Bathurst 1000 because there was no unification. The traditional race died and the V8 race continued on its own path. And in my personal opinion, the notion that it's all the same race is just plainly false. But I can concede most fans don't care generally. The general media doesn't know any better, and history and tradition has become cool in the last 20 odd years with the popularity of retro everything. So it's in Supercar's interest these days to promote and sell the link of the original Bathurst with their vision as being all the same. But I do ask why. Why aren't Supercars proud of their own history? And why aren't they proud of their own traditions? They didn't like the terms of the Bathurst 1000, so ultimately they created their own better version, but are also now so happy to adopt the history of something that in history's timeline is a completely different event. I guess it's really proof again that the winners write history. This to me hasn't got anything to do with Super Touring versus V8 Supercars or even really the Bathurst War. No one can dispute the V8s were more popular and the Bathurst 1000 died along with Super Touring not long after. But also no one can dispute that a 1,000-kilometre Bathurst Enduro was created for V8 Supercars in 1997 and it ran against the Bathurst 1000 and that newly created race is what survived. The event is fantastically popular, attracts big crowds and great TV ratings each year, and I've enjoyed watching every one of them since 1997. So for this podcast, we'll celebrate something that Supercars doesn't want to, the 25th anniversary of the first Australian 1000 Classic, and we'll talk about the 25 V8 1000s leading into this weekend's 26th. By the time the first race had come along, the event had gained a sponsor and adjusted the name to the Primus 1000 Classic for 1997. Then becoming the FAI 1000 Classic in 1998, before simply the FAI 1000 in 99 and 2000. They amazingly couldn't get a sponsor for 2001, so it was called the V8 Supercar 1000, before the Bob Jane Team Arts 1000 from 2002 to 2004. was also in the early 2000s that IMG, who had sold their stake in Avesco after 1997 but kept running the 1000, stopped organising the race, and V8 Supercars themselves took over running the event with their events arm. Then the long-running Supercheap Auto backing came in for 2005, running until 2020, with Repco taking over in 2021. They're just some of my views. Daniel, what are yours?
Well, Luke, to start with, that was a lovely synopsis of history there. I found myself gagging at some of those quotes that you pulled out from 1997 in particular. Brought back some horrible memories. But yeah, I think overall, I very much concur with the notion that there's a lot of V8 history washing that's gone on. Lacks a bit of integrity, but putting that aside and looking at the last 25 years of the event, yeah, from my point of view, I've been to a couple and, yeah, it was a car race. It was, do you know what I mean? Did what I had to. I'm probably not, I think throughout last 25 years, my interest or passion for the event is not what it was. So you'll probably get a bit of that notion from me throughout this chat. And I think, and I'm sure we'll get to it at some point as well, but I'm of the belief that it really took a knock when it became part of the wider championship, when it just became another race. I've got a feeling that was 99 or 2000, give or take.
Yep,
99. But yeah, I felt that was another kick in the balls for any kind of like tradition or, you know, linked to what, you know, they were trying to attach themselves to with that history and things like that. So yeah, probably one for us to pick up later. But yeah, there are my initial thoughts.
Yeah, it's definitely had a different feeling compared to the Bathurst 1000. Just the general feeling, the promotion, the way it's all run.
Yeah. And any Bathurst endurance race referred to as Race 31, like, is... I said vomit-inducing.
Well, it didn't even make sense that it's race 31 because there were 30 sprint races that year in the Australian Touring Car Championship, plus there were three non-championship races at Melbourne at the Grand Prix. There were two races on the Gold Coast, and there was a Sandown 500. So that makes it what Bathurst in 97 for the V8s would have been the 37th race that year.
Yeah, and I think that's what sums it up. It's almost like the story's more important than the substance to these lot. And I think that's a bit of a narrative that's consistent over the last 25 years.
Well, Daniel and I were just old enough to know what was going on in 1997. But Adam and Brock, you guys were probably too young. And I'm guessing the only Bathurst you really know is the V8s.
I am... I'm firmly in that camp of I don't really care. You are right. I am too young to remember anything really before it.
Yeah.
For me, you know, a date change, I mean, just because I didn't really live through it, like I lived through it physically, but I wasn't old enough. So to be honest, I don't really care. You know, it's not like the traditional event or the 2 liter event lives on. So, you know, the history washing side of it probably doesn't bother me so much. If the other event was still running and they were trying to do that, definitely. But, you know, it's all I know. It has no competition. It doesn't bother me as much as it might do had I lived through it like you and Daniel did.
I think that's a good point because we're not that far apart in age, but like you're sort of the next generation of fan coming through who doesn't know any different. It's a bit like a modern, you know, your younger NRL fan these days doesn't know much about the Super League War. All they know is the NRL. But
I think same year, wasn't it?
Pretty much. Yep.
I was four. So, I mean, no four-year-old's going to care. So, doesn't matter. Who cares?
What about you, Adam? Was your thinking influenced by me and Daniel?
Going off memory back then, I can't say it was too swayed. I think probably around 97-ish was when I really, really started taking notice of, you know, Bathurst and everything. And that was probably influenced by Daniel and yourself, with the interest in, you know, British touring cars and subsequently the Australian Super Touring Championships and everything around there. But probably from 97 onwards, that's when I really paid attention more. Prior to that, you know, we would watch Bathurst with it. You know, at that time, I would have been, what, 9 there. So piquing my interest there, like we were watching it and everything like that. But back then, as Brock said, a bit young.
You're a bit like Brock, as in like you just count it all as one. You don't really care about the separation, or
I don't know. Like there's different separation in there, and the history around that. That, you know, it's no longer the same race as it was prior to when only the 1000 was run by supercars for it. So there's definitely the tradition and everything has gone, and it's in the new one.
For me particularly, when I was growing up, like the long weekend tradition was Bathurst. It was always on the long weekend. But I guess for you two, the long weekend tradition now is the NRL Grand Final since 2001.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But the great old meme that gets floated around is, you know, the NRL Grand Final just means Bathurst's next weekend now.
Well, yeah, it's in many ways, in terms of the V8, Australian 1000 Classic, its traditional date is now the second week of October.
Correct, yeah.
Started on the third week, went to November, came back to the second week for a good 19 years. Then 2020, it went back to the original weekend, the third weekend. Then last year was in December. So it's floated around a few dates, but...
Yeah, and, you know, it's probably cemented itself. I don't think they'll move it unless something drastically happens. But if they want to search for it, you know, with, you know, the NRL Grand Final moving to a nighttime final, if they wanted to move it back into it, it wouldn't be like they're competing when NRL was still in the twilight or afternoon Grand Finals. So if they wanted to, they probably could, but it still wouldn't mean that they're going back to hosting the tradition as before for it.
What was the thinking about going October into November back to October? Like, what? Do you know what I mean? It's almost like they were not hedging, but do you know what I mean? It was like initially it was, what, 2 weeks after the first one, so mid-October. Then it went almost late November for a number of years, and then I can't remember when they went back to October.
Yeah, well, they originally moved it in 98 to November because the Gold Coast Indy wanted to move from April into the October. And they basically, for 98, they took the date, the third weekend of October, which is what Avesco had for the Primus 1000 in 97. Okay. And there were all sorts of rumours going around when the V8s would move their Bathurst to for 98. There was even the odd mention of Easter. But they eventually, well, the odd rumour of Easter anyway, I don't know if it was ever serious. But they ended up going for November. And then 99-2000, that became the last race of the championship in November. But then I think they wanted to get Bathurst away from being the final round. Because I suppose they thought that the Bathurst winner was overshadowing the championship winner. So for 2001, there was even talk for a while of trying to move it onto the long weekend because the Bathurst 1000 had died. But by then, into 2001, that's when the NRL had swooped in and moved their grand final into the October long weekend because it was always the last weekend of September.
Yeah.
But then they moved it to the Sunday night to have a nighttime grand final for the first time in 2001. So I suppose VO2 Supercars then just took the next weekend after.
But isn't it kind of, I guess, ironic that, sure, it was COVID-induced, but how they built up 2020 as the Bathurst was the final race for the year, and they were talking about crowning champions and, you know, the Bathurst 1000 or the Supercar 1000 winner at the same thing. And they did the big presentation to Scott McLaughlin in pit lane before they went up to the podium for the race winner in that. It's kind of funny how it, even though it was COVID induced, that it got brought back to being the final race then.
Yeah, I guess you've got to try and sell it when so 2020, you were everyone was sort of forced into doing whatever they could that year.
Yeah,
but you know, V8 Supercars has a history of they can change their minds on lots of things. So
yeah,
that was just one of them. I think one thing that in my head makes me think it's sort of fitting that to separate the V8 1000 from the Bathurst 1000 is that the whole evolution of motor racing, particularly from the late 90s into the 2000s, was when we started having a real emphasis around the world on things like parity, control parts, more use of the safety car, which has sort of in many ways changed how a lot of motorsport's been run. And I mean, you can't compare a modern day 1000 with even an early to mid 90s Bathurst 1000. Just the, you know, it's an all out sprint these days. It's a sprint between safety cars. It's all geared around the final sprint to the flag. And I think for me, like that, it's good in a way. It creates a split between what the race was and what the race is. Like if you compare it to Le Mans, the Indy 500, particularly the Indy 500, like it's got over 100 years of continuous history, but you can't compare the modern Indy 500 to even an Indy 500 of the early 90s. That the whole race is completely different. The makeup of the grid is completely different. It's a 500 mile sprint race now, and I think even Le Mans is going to become more like that now with the new regulations, the new hypercar regulations with balance of performance and everything, and particularly in all three of those enduros, Bathurst, Le Mans and Indy 500, like the reliability is so much better nowadays that the emphasis is more on the racing, not getting to the finish.
And I think that's you hit the nail on the head there, that, you know, the reliability through technology in componentry and what tools teams have available to them now to make sure the cars last, they can push them at it because they're bespoke parts, whereas, you know, as you said, in the early 90s they were weren't as advanced there, so the drivers still had to nurse the cars to a point to get them to the end. So yeah, you're right that, you know, the face of the race has changed due to technology, but then also through the rules. You know, the latest one I guess I find a bit interesting is the new safety car rules that they brought in with lucky dogs and just trying to get as many cars on the lead lap for the final, I guess, run to the flag from the final pit stop, try and get as many cars there. That's a bit contrived.
Well, I think there's in the V8 Supercars era of the race, there's always been a lot of changes made for the show, even right back to the late 90s, where, you know, you started having a minimum amount of pit stops put in, which I think started out was 4. And then, you know, compulsory brake pad changes and little things like that. And obviously over the years it's become, well, particularly when the race became a championship round, you started having things like you could only pit one car at once. If anyone goes back and watches the 1997 Primus 1000 in the TV coverage, you can see both the HRT Commodores come in. They're running 1-2 and they both follow each other into the pits and both cars get serviced at the same time and then they drive back out. Whereas obviously now stacking is a major part of the race.
And that can be fixed. Like I think there might be only, I think it's only the street circuits that have a real issue with pit lane space due to them being man-made structures designed by the promoter for them. But, you know, you go to any of the current circuits for there, you can easily have one boom per car and service the cars there. So, you know, that's an easy fix. And I think that's better for the show because there's nothing worse than a safety car comes out at the wrong time. And, you know, you've got two cars from the same team towards the front, and instantly, you know, one's sacrificed for the race, and they pick and choose who that's going to be for it. So that's definitely one thing that isn't great about the change there.
I was just going to say, too, the one of the other things to map through that is, and I say this loosely, but the regulation changes, you know, from the original carryover of Group A regs in, or not Group A, what do they call them? Group A five-liter touring cars in that were still in existence in 97, and then what, the early 2000s, they went to, was it Blueprint?
Yep.
Then, and then onto your Gen 1s, Gen 2s, and Gen 3s. So I guess whilst, you know, there's still a Holden and Fords or Chevs or, yeah, 25 years is a long time. Like, just to map the evolution of and how the cars have changed, to jump into what we have these days, which are basically silhouette sports sedans. I think that's another telling part of, you know, talking about the eras of the sport and how it's changed, or the, I should say the category, because it's not a sport.
Yeah, I'm with you guys in that the event has you know, changed a lot, and probably not for the best. I think Bathurst now is probably the least exciting it's ever been. I'm sure for the drivers it's more intense, because it is just flat out and they're all driving at such a high level. But the cars just can't pass. Double stacking wipes out half the field. And, yeah, it is just safety car after safety car. And generally for the first 100 laps, they just cruise around anyway, just following each other. Yeah, it's changed a lot, and definitely I think the car of the future, with the exception of probably 2013-14, from 2015 onwards, the race is just, I don't know, it's lacked something, but I can't quite put my finger on what it is. But then again, maybe I'm just getting old, and my golden era is the early 2000s, so nothing could ever possibly compare to that.
So you're getting more and more like me. The old days were always better. You're right about the car of the future. I think from 2013, it's been noticeably harder to pass and less passing. Like, you look at the 2013 race, like, Wincup was clearly the fastest car on the day, and he followed Winterbottom for the last 50-odd laps, and the closest he got was trying to go around the outside at Griffin's on the last lap.
Yeah, I mean, like, and just straying off Bathurst, I mean, I feel quite strongly about this. I'm sure a million people would disagree. For me, Car of the Future really changed the whole feel and vibe and everything about supercars for the worse. I know the whole thing was cutting costs, road relevance, more manufacturers, making them more tunable. It's achieved absolutely none of that. And it's just, the cars are way too refined. They're essentially a GT car with a Mustang body on them. Like, they're just rubbish to watch. I do not like them at all. And it's really affected the way and the rhythm of, what do you call it? The Australian Supercar V8 Primus 1000 Classic. What do you call it?
All of the above.
It's called the FAI 1000. And that's its traditional name.
One thing on that as well that has been chipped away and marginalized with, and Joe, me, it's tied to obviously the professionalism and that god awful franchise system that they champion. But the lack of the one off or the privateer or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, when you rocked up and one year we had 24 cars or something?
Yeah, 25. There was only the regulars.
No, that's what I mean. But it was kind of like, and from a safety reason, I'm not advocating cars that are running 45 seconds lap slot. But do you know what I mean? Like, it became too hard and too expensive. People who wanted to run a car at Bathurst couldn't. So the race lost that dynamic as well, and I know people argue that it's not the old days were, but I'm like, that was an element of the race that was lost. Like,
they just couldn't even fit them in if they could enter. Like, with all their pit bay rules and the spacing and everything required, like, you just can't even do it if you wanted to.
But Brock, you sit on the hill each February, take aside the last couple of years. How many cars sit in pit lane there?
Yeah, I know.
I'm not talking about 55 because I know that scares some of them. But I was like, geez, even if you had 35, that way they could still have. Well, that's still one car a garage, isn't it? I'm just doing quick.
Well, that's the thing. There's 36 two-car garages. Mm. When they designed the new pits, it was designed as 36 two-car garages. But right from 2004, supercars allotted one car per double garage. I don't think that was the actual intention of the garages.
No, because it wasn't the other idea of that was at the same time, potentially for the 24-hour, that you could house
72.
And that was them to counteract building the extension of the pit lane up Mountain Straight, which was mooted at the time. But like going off that, they allocate, I think it's one or two garages to Dunlop for tyres. The TV has a garage to themselves for TV. Larco's hub has a garage to itself. Then you've probably got, you know,
Fox would have a garage.
How many cars are entered?
28.
Okay, so we're still eight short. How many Super 2 cars?
No, well, there's three wild cards. Only one of them's a Super 2 entry, though. The other one's the third 888 car, and the other one's the third Erebus for Murphy and Stanaway. And
okay, cool. But, so three quality entries then.
Yeah. But could you argue in terms of separating the V8 1000 from the Bathurst 1000, the tradition of this race has been focusing on the championship cars because they started stopping the one-offs after 2000. Sort of 2001, 2002, you sort of had to commit. You had to have at least done some Konica rounds to have gotten on the grid at Bathurst. And then sort of from there, they started then weeding out the Konica cars. And then by 2004 with the new pits, you had to be a full-time entry in the championship to run in the 1000. And then it was only 2009 they started with the wildcard concept to start letting sort of one-off entries, but even the one-off entries, you had to pass their criteria.
Mm.
So in many ways, the tradition of this race is like focused on the championship. And, you know, I had a watch of, in the lead up to this, I had a watch this afternoon of the 97 Primus 1000 Classic. And there's a bit of it with early in the race, Murphy's chasing down Larry Perkins. And they're lapping cars. And you don't see that anymore. You don't see cars getting lapped in the 1000.
Mm.
Unless there's something wrong with them. Because you generally don't get a long enough green flag period.
Well, I think last year's one was, 80 something laps before the first safety car for the Echidna on the track. And I think Mostert had 40-second lead at that point or something, wasn't it? Or
something like that. I think he was off strategy, though, wasn't he?
Well, because he had the tyre delaminate.
That's pretty solid, though. 81 laps. I wouldn't have guessed that.
Well, 2017 in the wet, they went like 90 laps before the first safety car in the pouring rain. And the first safety car was only because Alex Prema broke down and parked it up on the racing line at the cutting.
That's right.
That was the only reason for the first safety car. And then,
which was surprising because you think of the lack of wet running they had that year.
That was when the 888 cars were driving down Conrad Straight and they were pulling the squeegees out of the door trim.
That they had the rule rewritten after that because didn't Macaulay Jones try that this year and he got black flagged? Was that Tail and Bend? I think it was Tail and Bend. Yeah, whatever race it was, wet race they had, so.
In the rundown, Brock thought we were going to talk about him for a few minutes, but we were meaning Peter Brock, and the original 1997 Primus 1000 Classic got a bit of a leg up, given that Peter Brock announced his retirement, and that was going to be his last or full-time V8 supercar race, and sort of the, originally it was going to be the end of his career. But that definitely gave this new race a real head start.
The the start of the John Farnham tour.
Yeah, pretty much.
I guess, yeah, like, I guess you look at it, Peter Brock was synonymous with the traditional event. So having him there in his swan song season in 97, which was tipped to be, it was always going to have a good presence there of Peter Brock fans to follow him. And then subsequently, you know, he wheeled out after 97, was it 2001? 2002 on the Brock car, and then 2004 with Jason Plato, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The infamous rollover.
But he originally said he wasn't going to count. He wouldn't have counted a 97 Promise 1000 Classic win as his 10th. And then he was originally heavily rumoured to have going to have made a comeback in the aborted 1999 Bathurst 1000 that never happened. He was going to drive with James Brock. Yep, he was going to drive with James Brock in a future Tourer Commodore, but that never happened. And then obviously with the team Brock joining V8 Supercars in 2002, that's when Brock did make a comeback. I guess in a lot of ways that's what spurred on the merging of the history by some quarters in the Peter Brock links with the comeback.
Yeah, it's a good point. It also gave, yeah, I was going to say, for them it worked out quite well, didn't it? Like him retiring and that being the first event. So it kind of gave it a platform to celebrate it. But you're right, probably reinforced by the multiple comebacks that he was involved in, yeah.
Do you think he should have made the comebacks?
I think history says no. Bond, but the 2002 one, at least I kind of get that because he was, do you know what I mean, it was the way to try and launch that team or, you know, give that team a leg up. Obviously, it didn't work out, but at least that had a bit of strategy behind it. And by all the rumoured amounts that they made just from merchandise that weekend, he probably wasn't wrong to have a go. Just pity the car was that... unsorted that weekend. I think even Craig Baird has even gone on record to say how much that car was struggling with him in it, who had driven it most of the year.
Looks good though.
Yeah, the black
was gold. Yeah.
Back with Motorola was cool.
Motorola,
absolute peak retro for me. Everyone gets excited about the 70s. Who cares, mate? That is peak retro.
But I guess you look at with a name like Peter Brock, if he wanted to drive a car, I don't think anyone was going to say no, like to the notion of it. Like you look at, I know even though Greg Murphy had his arm twisted by Peter Adderton to come race, well, it was supposed to be last year, but now it's this year. But like those people who were, I guess, household names of the sport in their time, if they want to keep going and someone's going to stump up a car for them, I think, you know, everyone's going to hold on to the heyday of the category. Like if, you know, Glenn Seaton wanted to drive a wild car with a wild card entry with like Aaron Seaton, for instance, say Matt Stone Racing put out an extra car, I think everyone would jump on that because it's Glenn Seaton. Much the same as, you know, when, I guess it was different for when the Johnsons teamed up because it was kind of the crossover period between Dick finishing and Steven starting at that time. But yeah, pretty much if a, you know, a household name wanted to drive it, you know, they're always going to find a way if it's commercially viable.
You were happy your namesake made a comeback, Brock?
Yeah, why not? I'm pretty chill. So I think it was cool, and it was a cool looking car, and it was in Holden, and it was also, you know, the image as Scaife was coming down to take the flag, he like lapped Peter Brock, and it was just a good image. So yeah, thumbs up from me. It was all cool.
At least he got his 10th Bathurst win in a proper race.
Italy, you can't. Yeah, I was like, claiming that is just as ridiculous.
I think his comebacks were all right. If anything, it reinforced he shouldn't have retired in 97. People talk about, you know, not spoiling your legacy by going on too long, but I always think you keep going for as long as you enjoy it, because if you stop when you don't want to stop, there'll always be either a sadness in I should have gone on longer, and or you make aborted comebacks later on. But I think the 2002 comeback was all right for the reasons Daniel said. And even the 04 drive with Jason Plato in the HRT car, I think given he'd done a full 2003 Nations Cup schedule and he'd raced a little bit earlier in 2004 in the Monaro, I mean, he was a bit more race ready than he was for the 2002 race, but it just didn't work out. Plato didn't seem to adapt to the car as well as maybe they thought he would, which ended up, I think Brock ended up qualifying it. He was sort of ended up being the main driver when I think he was probably originally signed to be the co-driver to Plato.
But I guess circling back to, you know, saying for, you know, people going past their prime and why they'll do it, I guess it's each to their own of why they want to do it. If, you know, someone, you know, is past there and think they can still win when clearly they're not, they can't, is different to someone who's going, you know, I may not be where I was 5-10 years ago for it, but I want to race in the 1000 event. It's a cool event. I can still drive. I'm not expecting to win. I just want to go out and have fun and drive and still be a part of the event. It can do it. Like, why not? Why not let someone do it?
All right. Well, on the King of the Mountain, we'll take a quick break and be back shortly. Breakthrough Health and Wellness. The Breakthrough 60-Day Challenge combines a highly effective weight loss program and a high-end personal fitness experience without costly memberships. In a culture of flash workouts and going hard, Breakthrough have taken a more sustainable approach and developed the perfect program that will not only get you fit and healthy, but also help you shed stubborn weight that you thought was never going to budge. Breakthrough will offer new inspiration and goals that will lead to life changes you can easily maintain. Each week, Breakthrough offer interesting muscular endurance, strengthening and functional movement exercises with a training app that will rival any workout you have done at the gym. For more information, visit mybreakthrough.com.au. That's MYBREAKTHRU. And follow Breakthrough on Facebook and Instagram. Welcome back to our podcast. Now, guys, what's your favourite race of the Australian 1000 Classic era?
I'll jump in early. So my favourite race is, like, just for a race, is 2000. Obviously, I was a big Tander fan, so that helps. Love the wet weather, ridiculously big field, all the privateers, a VT Gatorade Commodore with Dorman on the side. Need I say any more? That's it. You know, clearly that's the winner. But for feel, memories, nostalgia, I'm going to say the 2003 race, because things changed after that 2003 race. And I think that was the last race that really had that old school feel about it. And like, my memories of Bathurst and what I feel when the weather changes, and you're driving up there and you see the sign and it's Bathurst weekend, I always reflect back on those 2003 and earlier races. So I'm going to say 2000 for, like, the quality of the actual race and the action, 2003 for everything else surrounding it.
2000 was a funny race. It was quite good, very action-packed, a lot of different leaders and a lot of controversies going on through it. Particularly the Matt Neal, Neil Crompton get together at turn one. But and then sort of you had Longhurst leading after making a million pit stops, and then he ends up leading with a couple of laps to go, and then the Asia Online Commodore got in his way coming into Forest Elbow.
Yep.
And then sort of Tander and Barguana, who'd been there, they'd been there all race, and they were in the right spot at the right time.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know, it was just cool, mate. I'd just do anything to for it to go back to be anything like that these days would be great.
Yeah, the 2000 race, that's one of the few that I've watched in full as well over the 25-year history. And Luke is the fault of that, because you were at schoolies and I had to record the whole thing for you.
I think we tag-teamed that one, didn't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
I was going to say, that's the only one I haven't watched live because I was on schoolies and there was only one TV in this place and I wasn't allowed to annex it for the whole day. And I couldn't follow it on social media at the time. So every time there was an ad break in something else, because it was pouring rain at Bathurst, but it was also pouring rain at schoolies. So there everyone was inside. So anytime there was a little break in the TV, I'd be like, oh, can I flick it on Channel 10? And
And at the time, I don't know why, but I was not a Gary Rogers motorsport fan, which sounds ridiculous now because they're one of the few good teams in the country. But at the time, so when they won, I was like, oh, dirtbags.
Super Touring exploits?
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know. Probably because they didn't continue with the Prime Era. Yeah.
Or the Alpha, or the Honda.
Nah, but I think the Primera was, if they would have stuck around, they could have, imagine what a Nissan Primera, anyways, that's a different podcast, but what they could have achieved with that.
Do you want to know why you weren't a fan of them, Daniel?
Because you were a fan of them?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, no, well, mate, once again, it's hard to argue, isn't it? It's like, it proves, yeah. But yeah, at the time, but now I can't get enough of them.
Yeah, see, now I've gone off them.
2003 is funny, I remember that just for the Murphy dominance.
There was more men. Remember the crash at Skyline?
Yeah.
All swinging open after Bow ran into it. There was Tander turning around Bow in the first lap of the race at the Elbow, and there was so much going on. It had Billy Woods. It was just, mate. It was what it was all about, you know.
I do remember Scaife's charge early on because he qualified. I think he was seventh after the shootout. And he got to the lead within sort of 10 laps or so.
Yeah, we had, you know, obviously Murphy's quali lap, but also Jim Richards' quali lap, which everyone...
Yes.
Which was, mate, it was just a good era. Like, it had all the privateers in there. Oh.
Just to clarify, are we using Bill Woods as a positive differentiator for the race?
For the nostalgia factor, you know, the other day, no joke, I was driving home, it was late, and I was flicking through and I flicked through and it went on to 2GB. And I'm just obviously like pressing the button to skip through. And I heard Billy Woods. And I was like, no way. This is an absolute, what a gem to find.
That would have been the Brown Shirt Brigade, wouldn't it? 2003? Or they honored the blue shirts by then?
2000, the Brown Shirts came. They wore them at Canberra.
Well, Canberra was 2001.
Yeah, I'm sure they had the blue shirts at Canberra.
Probably early 2000s with the Brown Shirts. They had the blue denim shirts in the late 90s.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, you know you're getting old when someone's saying Bill Woods is nostalgia.
Well, you would have had Barry Sheen at that time too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, Barry was there then. Yep.
Yep. Mark Osler.
See, there's a name that they need to get back. Imagine Larko and Mark Osler on the commentary team.
Nah, Osler wasn't there in 03, was he? It was Matty White. Crompton and Billy Woods.
Yeah, I should clarify when we mentioned Barry Sheen, then we're talking in that era, but obviously he passed away unfortunately earlier in 2003.
Yeah.
By the time the 03 Bathurst.
Yeah.
But remember the Pizza Box SBR car?
Yes, I didn't mind that. The Pertec Haviland car.
It was cool, man. Like that was cool. Like bring that back, you know.
Yeah.
We need that. Like, I would pay money to go watch that. Now it's better to watch the race on TV. Back then, it was better to watch the race live.
Probably narrowed it down to two. The one where Matthias Ekstrom and Andy Prio ran that, like, green
Xbox
Commodore.
2013.
Yeah, so that one, just because they were pretty competitive. Relatively competitive. A lot of people obviously struggled a bit, like my boys Hinch and Rossi. But I thought that was pretty cool. Just that they had, and I'm not saying they were going to win, but do you know what I mean? Like just relatively competitiveness, which was really good. So that 2013, what a race. But then equal to that, I was at the 2002 Bob Jane Team Arts Australian 1000 Classic. And the opening stint was the Aussie Male Brad Jones and Jay Cleland car that led the opening stint.
Yeah.
So I was still obviously super touring John Cleland, hanging on the, you know, the last, I think he retired in the 99 season. And then obviously Brad Jones exploits in the Audi. So yeah, like that was pretty cool watching that opening stint. Obviously it fell away for the good guys, but just being, yeah, watching that opening stint, 20, 30 laps there with those guys leading, that was really cool.
Yeah, that was a good first stint because he had Scaife right on him. And I think Murphy was somewhere in there too during that first stint. But that was like 30 laps, just the three of them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they've been like relatively again, but like, yeah, broke the rest of the field kind of thing. It was, yeah, there was a nose to tail out front, but they were, yeah, they'd create a bit of a gap. So yeah, no, that was pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. O2 was the year of the plastic bags as well.
Yes, but we left before the end.
It was Daniel's chip packet.
That's right, because you were there with Konica, weren't you, Dingham?
Yeah. So we were up there as guests. So it was a great honour, and it was, if I'm getting my history right, the year the tent blew onto the the track.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that was your tent too, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, well, actually, it's funny enough though. It's because that's why we lock our tent at the 12-hour down so well now. I just have visions of that happening. So,
and why did you leave before the end of the race?
So they booked the charter flight back to Sydney, leaving at pick a time, and then so it was like the whole group, not just us, like that. Basically, if you wanted a flight back to Sydney, you had to get the bus, and it was leaving this time to get to the airport. Rah rah rah! Turn up there, and the pilots weren't there, so we ended up watching the end of the race from the airport, Bathurst Airport. So
the pilots were still at the track.
Yeah, some people were blowing up. I couldn't give two shits, but it was like an absolute comical of errors and things too. Yeah. So, but no, I think that stuck with me. That opening stint, that was really enjoyable. And yeah, obviously like just the old pits and things, getting down on the grid. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And Dad still dines out on the story because he was there with you that day that he went to the toilet and stood next to Peter Brock.
Isn't it funny? Father and son stories. Dad takes a slash next to the great Peter Brock, and then 9 years later, I am at the troughs next to the great Mario Andretti. So, you know, whoever says don't meet your heroes in the bathroom are wrong.
What's your favourite race, Adam?
Oh, I'm going to go against the grain for it and go a bit more modern, 2014.
Go fuck yourself.
Only pulling your leg. That was a doozy of a day, that one. But I'd say my probably favourite of the V8 era is 07 for that one.
Sorry, I have traumas over that race. End of him in that era. So, that's terrible day.
Oh, it was just, I think the just how the end of the race unfolded, like the race through it all had a bit of everything through it, but that final, I guess, portion of the race where, you know, Winterbottom came into the chase when it started sprinkling and threw it down the sand trap for there, you know, they put that vision on every year coming through, you know, that they pretty much had it in the bag if he kept going that way. But then once the race got going again, you had that great tussle. I think it was Steve Johnson in the Jim Beam Falcon. You had Lounsey.
Coolest thing about that race was it got to a point where if Bright pitted and it rained, Bright wins that race.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
And Greg Ritter in the second GRM car, he was sort of on a similar, I think they put wets on, sort of took a gamble. They put wets on, and they, if it had rained, they would have been in the in a good spot. But the other thing with that bit was the safety car that originally ended up getting thrown, which then the first lap after the safety car was when Scaife, Ingall and Bright hit the wall at on the approach to McPhillamy. Paul Morris spun at the cutting and sort of touched the wall and all that, and then they threw the safety car. But no sooner, I think he got going, or he was in the process of getting back going again when the safety car got called. And obviously, once you call it, you can't rescind it. But then sort of the TV cuts back to it and Morris is driving back going again. So he sort of set up
the final run.
The final run to the finish. But the other bit was when, because that race was dominated by the number six Castrol Falcon of Winterbottom and Stephen Richards, with Lowndes and Wincup giving chase. Remember, Wincup dropped it coming into the pits for one of the last pit stops, maybe the last pit stop from memory.
Very lucky to get it out.
That was that weird era where the whole HSV cars were quicker than the HRT cars.
Yeah.
Which was not good.
Yeah. Well, then at the end of 2007, that's after Rick Kelly won in 06 and then Tander won the championship in 07, that's when they basically raided the Toll team to try and make – they basically killed the team. Rick Kelly drove it in 2008, but then the Kellys went and did their own thing for 2009.
Yeah.
But no, fair play to 07. That wasn't bad. I will say that your original mention of 2014, that's a I mean, that's the epitome. Like, a lot of people say that's their favorite. That's the best Bathurst ever. I mean, that's proof in the pudding that it's only the end that matters. You know, a good finish makes an exciting race.
Yeah.
Because the race was a shocker. a very exciting finish. Like, sometimes I've just watched the last 20 laps. Like, but I mean, the race was, you know, there wasn't a lot of passing. They sat around for an hour or whatever doing nothing. Yeah, in the middle, you know, that there were a lot of safety cars for crashes and that, you know. It was an awesome finish.
Yeah,
I could watch it all the time, but I mean, it wasn't an awesome race.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that stop in the race there when it got going, arguably, you know, after that's when McLaughlin glanced the wall coming out of the cutting and put them out of the race, and they were kind of in the box seat. But that was the whole point when they were parked up for an hour, where people were making repairs to the car, and they said, I think the Volvo needed to change a starter motor for it, and they were saying they can't do it. And Gary Rogers was fired up, saying, you know, everyone else is fixing their cars and we can't change a starter motor. Like, what's no one knew what was doing, what was going on.
I get a transaxle put in it or something crazy.
I think so. Yeah, they changed something in Wincup's car. Yeah.
Yeah.
Starter motor on the 97 car.
Well, yeah, I mean, he had a good chance of winning anyway. I don't think he would have come out leading from that last pit stop where he stalled it, but.
But he had the pace.
Yeah. I'd have to say, for me, there's a couple of good races. I thought 98 was a good endurance race in terms of sort of, there wasn't a lot of safety cars. Sort of the HRT car led most of the day. And then it was a bit of an old-fashioned endurance race, but into sort of the more modern sort of the way the races pan out. I thought 05 wasn't a bad race. Obviously, you had the Ambrose Balaclava gate.
But does that make that a memorable part of the race? You know, obviously you got the Balaclava gate into Murphy Ambrose up at the cutting. For it, does that overshadow 05 and make that a better race than the eventual winner?
I mean, you had the early part of the race where Lowndes was taken off and then he hits the wall, and then the racing itself, I think, was quite good in 2005.
05 is when he copped the tyre, wasn't it?
Yeah. 2009, that's not a bad race. Sort of, it's raining at the start, and then sort of, I think it's Tander and Scaife sort of pull away a bit after it dries out. They spend a bit of time at the front And then, I mean, the last probably 40, 50 laps, particularly the battle behind Rick Kelly in the last stint when he's dropping oil and everyone's sliding around behind him. And the thing is, it's hard for me to say a Holden win was my favourite race.
Oh, geez, choking up there, Luke.
Yeah, oh. Probably 98. I have to go 98, I think.
What a crock.
Because that was what, Richards Murphy, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
In the car. Yeah.
And you had Larkham and Jones were sort of in amongst it as well, and until they had a problem under safety car towards the end.
You're talking about 98?
98, yeah.
Richards Bright.
Sorry, what did I say? Richards Murphy.
Oh, sorry, you're right. I assumed you said Bright. Jeez, but look at that. Brock's schooling me, and he doesn't like the old days.
I like those old days because I remember them.
All right, what's your most controversial moment?
Well, so I'm just going to get this out of the way, and you all know what the answer is going to be. It's 2019, because, I mean, this is just disgraceful. So, let's not get into it. It's 2019 by an absolute mile.
What happened 2019?
Something worse than Abu Dhabi 2021.
You mean a budget cap breach?
Yeah, no, that whole safety car thing was just, yeah, that's the most controversial moment. So,
aren't they still trying to find out where the Debris was?
Yeah, and, you know, the motor issue on Friday, which is a shame because I think it took the shine off that thing for Scott, and I think he deserved it. But, yeah, like the motor, the safety car issue, it's just ridiculous. So that has to be it.
The race's pit stop rules, though, had been crying out for someone to do that for years.
But that's the like, thing. Everyone's always done it. They just kind of took it to the next level.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, people have sort of backed off a bit under safety cover. I mean, yeah, like you said, they did it to extreme. But I mean, like, did it deserve a penalty?
Oh, it deserved the entire team to be thrown out of the race.
But he was driving safely under safety car.
Yeah,
and the silly double stacking rules. I mean, it was crying out for someone to exploit him.
Well, look, one card's disqualified, so, and the other one should have been too.
Well, I think the only thing that was going against it is you got to maintain, what is it, 3 or 4 car lengths for the car in front under safety car. I think that's where it kind of ended any argument of driving.
Oh, but that's safely. That can't be a rule, because what if you're 5 seconds behind them when the safety car gets called?
But I think that's when they look at it and say you got to catch the train.
But everyone goes flat out. There was no train because the safety car got called.
Yeah.
Wincup and McLaughlin. They took off because they'd given up on trying to make the finish by then.
Yeah.
So they were going flat out to make the pits. And then, I mean, I don't think Coulthard was that far behind McLaughlin, but, I mean, he wasn't within 4 car lengths of him, I don't think.
No.
I mean, surely you only have to keep 4 car lengths once you're behind the safety car.
Yeah, once you caught the train, I think it's in there. But, like, I think even at the time, Triple Eight, not to the extent that Shell V-Power did it, but, you know, they weren't, you know, innocent in holding up the train in previous years. They just didn't do it to that extent, and I think every other team would have done it to a certain point to limit the double stack, but yeah, I don't think anyone had ever thought about taking it to that extreme.
All I'll say about the 2019 race is I thought it's a shame that when DJR were choosing a retro livery for this year, it's a shame they didn't decide to run a Scott McLaughlin retro 2019 victory livery.
And moving on.
what about the end of the 2016 race?
Not compared to 2019.
No?
No.
Do you think Wincup deserved a penalty?
I don't know. Who cares? I hold one. It doesn't matter.
Well, I think the biggest thing in that is, I guess if you separate it, was how the redress happened, and then, you know, taking advantage. Obviously, Tander was like rubbing his hands together. Look, he's slowing down to redress. McLaughlin's rejoin playing into that. You know, it was a kind of the Swiss cheese moment where it all aligns and exploded.
Well, yeah, because when McLaughlin pops back out on the track, he doesn't just pop out on the right hand, stay on the right hand side. He pops out back into the middle of the track.
Yeah, yeah, and so, I think that's where if he popped out and stayed to the right hand side of the track, and they went three wide down there, I don't think it's too much of an issue. But because of what happened with McLaughlin coming back into the center, I think they thought they had to make a choice there.
Yeah. But also then to give him give Wincup a 15-second penalty after the safety car.
Yeah.
I mean, he was never going to get anything back after that.
Well, as a Red Bull, maybe you should have offered to give the position back.
They should have just put him at the end of the train or something.
Oh, yeah.
Because at least then you can fight back. I mean, a 15-second penalty, you can't, after a safety car, you're never going to get that back that late in the race.
No, no.
Yeah, that was a bit of a... Oh, I was happy Will Davison won. I haven't minded Will Davison for many years. I actually the Styx colour scheme is one of my favourites. So I was happy enough to see that car win. But I just thought that 2016 had a bit of a funny feeling to it in the way that ended to me.
Well, my controversial moment is the use of discretionary safety cars in the final part of the race. For, you know, going off at that, you know, there always seems to be a safety car, you know, on the last, I don't know, say 10 to 15 laps. Sometimes you look at it and go, does that really need to be a safety car? Some of them are legitimate. So when a car hits the wall, you know, and it's in a dangerous spot, you have to call a safety car. But there has been plenty of times where a driver's hit the wall and, you know, coming up to McPhillamy, it's hard left and doesn't need it, and they call a safety car, but a car hits the wall in the same spot with a lap or two laps to go, and it's, oh no, it's not a safety issue, you know, let's just keep racing the flag and hang out yellow flags. It's like, well, if it's a safety car five laps prior, it's a safety car now. And, you know, then you get into the...
Aren't you a NASCAR fan?
Yeah. Green, white checkers.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, isn't that like the whole premise of NASCAR? Let's just do whatever we possibly can to make some action for the end.
Yeah. Like, I think, what was it, the race the other time, they had like three green, white checkers or something like that for one race. But like, that's NASCAR, and they've put that in for every race and everything like that. But, you know, just bringing that in for Bathurst, well, they bring in the safety car lucky dog rule just for Bathurst. So, you know, they can do what they want there. But I think that's a pretty controversial moment, their liberty of safety cars at the final part of the race.
Yeah, I think safety cars have always been a bit rubbery in terms of what they throw them for and what they don't.
Secondly, do we throw out the 5-minute penalty?
Ooh. Yeah, that was probably fair enough.
5 minutes, though?
Yeah, well, he nearly could have burnt the pit lane down.
Well, they would have got the new pit lane quicker.
True. Probably. Oh, I mean, it seemed a bit of a... It seemed like they plucked the penalty from nowhere, but, I mean, if you drop fuel everywhere...
Same thing happened to Mark Eadie.
Well, did he get a 5-minute?
Yeah, same thing, 2012.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Okay. All right, yeah.
All right, 2004, Alan Gurr puts the Serum A Wines car...
His career's over.
Morris gets on TV and ends his career.
Hey, go easy on Gurr. That was we were big supporters of his in 2002.
And three.
For 2002, the Pepsi Dougal McDougal Yeah, that was my car that day.
But it didn't really end his career because he went on to drive for Britec in 05?
In 07.
07.
But he drove for Moritz in 05, I think.
Yeah.
Him and Fabian Coulthard, I think, shared a car.
Yeah.
But it was just a controversial moment.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And just the way he so casually said it, he was just like, oh, that's the end of his career.
But imagine if he came out and said that in 2020 or 2022. Imagine if Morris came out and said that on TV today. People will be having you know, shit and kittens or whatever from, you know, someone coming out and saying that on TV.
Ah, people would love it.
Who knows? Well, maybe. 50% would hate it and 50% would love it.
What's your most controversial moment, Daniel?
Maybe the whole balaclava thing, I guess. That's something pretty petty. But
because I guess coming out of it, you know, as history gets retold over the years and how apparently all the drivers had an agreement to say that, you know, we're not going to run it. And then subsequently another team team personnel or a driver for another team saw it in the race and wanted to call it out. It was a pretty heated year in 05 between a couple of drivers up and down the grid with the Pertec Ambrose car for it. So, you know, if that's the way, it's, you know, not in the gentlemanly code.
Would you say Win Cup pretty much having a chance to win every race for the last 15 years and only having four wins, would you say that's a bit controversial?
Ooh, probably.
In the terms of he threw away a lot of wins?
15 probably is the most controversial, I think. Because 16 was just like racing incident, whatever. But 15 with that safety car, that was pretty out there.
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't say in that controversial. You make a conscious decision at the time and it pays off or it doesn't pay off. At that time, you know, whether or not, you know, from what the footage shows to what he did, you know, you even look what happened to Pukekohe in 2019 with the safety car coming out there and what he did and just drove past it to make a statement about it because his race was over, you know, makes a conscious decision. Would I call it controversial? Probably not.
Actually, you know what? I wouldn't say it's controversial, but it was pretty big, and it sort of faded into obscurity. No one talks about it. Remember when Reynolds got that cramp? Like, they were dead set going to win that race. And, like, I don't know, that just doesn't get talked about anymore, which he's probably really happy about.
Yeah.
That was nuts at the time. Like,
well, especially as it set up Lowndes' last win to date.
Mm.
But, yeah, Reynolds was... He was the pace setter all weekend. And like Brock said, and Luke Yulden was really good in the car that day too. They were giving everyone a caning.
Mm.
The car had the endurance, but not the driver.
Well, it's still the test of man and machine. I guess that shows it. do we speak controversial? Do we bring up the Supergirls and Dave Reynolds?
Yeah, you can.
I guess controversial, like the Dave Reynolds one. Like, apparently, you know, that's what they called the car the whole way through in the lead up even in the team thing. But I guess, you know, it's, you know, at that point in time, you know, to the general public, no one knew that. They thought it was just a comment. But
you're always going to cop a fine for saying something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a PC person, but you got to know if you say something like that, they're going to pull you up for it. Especially when they'd made such a big deal about Harvey Norman being involved, and
yeah,
you know, Harvey Norman were only involved for because there were females driving the car. What rule change do you reckon has had the biggest impact on the race? They changed to E85 fuel in 2009, which shortened up the fuel runs. They would get, you know, around 32 on average, maybe 31 on average under the previous fuel they used. But the change to E85 ethanol sort of the stints now ever since then have sort of been 21, 22, maybe 23 laps if you're getting good economy. Also, in 2013, they brought in a minimum amount of pit stops, which I think seven for the race, which, I mean, that pretty much meant you had to pit every 20 laps if you wanted to split the race up. That was originally to help the Nissan and Mercedes engines with Car of the Future. But also then in 2010, you had the rule change where if you're a lead driver in the championship, you couldn't pair up with another full-time driver. So, for instance, Lowndes and Wincup couldn't team up anymore. Tander and Davison couldn't team up anymore, which was a big change. And also, as Daniel alluded to earlier in the podcast, in 1999, they made Bathurst a round of the championship. But, I mean, they've all had impacts on the race. Which one do you reckon was the biggest?
Ooh, I think, yeah, it's for me, as you're rattling them off there, I was like, every time you said one of them, I'm like, yeah, that's it. So that, like, they've all had impact. I think I can't split the championship one because I think that really changed how the event was viewed, and it kind of, in a way, marginalized it as just a part of the championship. You had some drivers who were driving for with the championship in mind, which had never really happened in that style of event before. So I think that was huge. And sad in a way, but the driving one, I think that, the drivers being dictated who they could pair up with and not pair up from. Yeah. Like for me, that's a major change and a major loss, because you think, like, it was always great watching the two A grade cars or drivers jump in together. Like obviously Lowndes and Wincup were particularly impressive.
Well, secondly, that also stopped, you know, teams throwing two young guys in a second car, guys with limited experience. Now, because you got your lead driver in each car, you kind of need someone who's got the experience, got the miles, and, you know, and the subsequent of that is it's pushed up the co-driver's pay, which a lot of different people have mentioned across the media. Which, you know, co-drivers aren't complaining about. They get their payment for driving's gone up, but then it's also stifled some other people in other ways as well. So
I think the change to E85 has made a big change, particularly in the end of the race. Basically, now everyone knows they're going to have to pit around lap 140. I think it's pretty much geared the, you know, everyone says the last safety car, the last pit stop. It's basically pushed the crucial point of the race now, where it used to be around lap 130. Now it's been pushed to sort of 140, even a little bit later, depending on how your pit stops have gone earlier in the race.
Well, most engineers go from the last lap, what's the maximum laps they've gotten for fuel? And they go, okay, we're here, this is where, if it runs green, we need to stop. And then they adjust that as the race goes on and then keep pushing it back. And that's when, you know, on the last stint, that's when they start getting them to save early on. And it becomes a who can save the most to limit the amount of fuel. So it's, yeah, that, oh, I think that then coupled into the minimum pit stops, they kind of go one in one together.
Yeah. I think the rule is seven pit stops at the moment. I mean, on E85, you got to make at least six. But I mean, anytime you mandate pit stops takes a bit of the fun out of it. But
yeah, well, you look at that and go, okay, E85, they're going to get 23 laps or somewhere around about that. So they're going to have to make seven minimum. If a team can, you know, eke out 24, 25 laps, and then, you know, they might be able to sneak it on six stops, or, you know, six in the splash, or, you know, whatever there. Like, it's just kind of taken it out of the ability of someone who can conserve in an endurance race instead of being an all-out sprint. And secondly, since Nissan and Mercedes and Volvo all pulled out, there isn't the economy issue that prioritizing between the push rods and the, you know, the double overhead cam engines, trying to even out the fuel burn rate, that's gone. So, you know, don't need the minimum pit stops in there.
I'm in two minds about the being a round of the series, in as much as in terms of the Australian 1000 Classic, it's been a round of the series for 23 years out of the 25. So, you know, the tradition has been it's a round of the championship. But I definitely think that affects their approach to it. And right from the start in 1999, they split up Scaife and Lowndes.
Yeah, because Morris jumped in one of the cars, didn't he?
Scaife car, yeah. And Lowndes drove with McConville. So that's right from
the
start.
No, that's fair, yeah. That is probably consistent with the event's tradition, yeah.
And that's how, right from when Avesco was formed, their idea was they always wanted Bathurst to be not the be-all and end-all. They wanted the championship to be up there alongside it. And, I mean, that making it around, I guess, brought Bathurst down a peg while also raising the championship up a peg. But it definitely, you can't say it doesn't affect a championship contender's approach to the race. And it definitely affects who they team them up with, especially now with when you have lead drivers that can't team up. I think that's affected enduros in general, because now Bathurst and previously Sandown, it's become, the idea is just to get your co-driver laps out of the way. So they choose someone who's safe, can do the lap times, but the idea is they just want to get the drivers 54 laps done and out of the car so the main drivers can sprint home. And usually not long after halfway these days, the lead drivers are back in the car all the way to the end, because they just get the co-drivers laps out as soon as possible.
Yep.
So I think that definitely it has an impact on the race.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you even hear of it. I think Van Gisbergen came out and said that, you know, I got 500 points in the bag to P2 in the championship, means I can, you know, give 100% to Bathurst. Whereas if he was, say, 250 points in front or 200 points in front, he may not push it and not change his thought from, I don't have a care in the world, I'm going for the win, was, I'm going to hold back so I finish in the top five so I can maintain my points gap or not minimize it and, you know, risk losing his buffer that he's got. So, yeah, 100% change the mentality in a championship chase.
If I had to pick one, I'd probably say the E85, but only just, I mean.
But I guess, yeah. Circling back to being a part of the championship, if you look at marquee events in championships around the globe, they're all a part of championships now, whereas before they'll standalone races previously. Like Le Mans is part of the World Endurance Championship now. Indy 500 is a part of the IndyCar Championship. Daytona 500 kicks off the NASCAR series. I guess they're trying to encompass the marquee events to pump up their championships in some fashion there. So I think it was probably inevitable that it was going to happen if it wasn't Avesco making that change. I still think in 2022 it would be a part of the championship, whoever was running the main touring car series in Australia.
Who knows? Things would have changed. So the whole Australian motorsport would be down a completely different path.
True.
If different decisions were, I don't think you can even, that's a completely parallel universe.
True, true.
Which we wouldn't necessarily say no to being in. But the start time of the race, it was quite late last year. It's back to, I think, 11:15 for this year. Obviously, the Primus 1000 started at 10 a.m. in 1997, which was obviously the same as the Bathurst 1000 had started since 1978. Went to 10:30 in 2007. and has gradually gotten later. It was quite late last year, but it's come back a bit earlier this year because it's a bit earlier in the year. But I can totally understand why it's for TV that they start it later, because they want the race finishing as close to the 6 p.m. news as they can, with enough time to fit in the podium and that. So it's a long way from the days of the Bathurst 1000 when the race had finished at 4:30 and they'd have an hour highlights before ending the coverage. But to me, it's made the 1000, it's an afternoon race now. It's not a whole day's tradition. Like, the build up on TV is almost as long as the race itself now. Like, the build up might be 4 and a bit hours, and the race is going to go, I mean, if there's not many safety cars, the race is over in almost bang on 6 hours.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess classic example of that is last year's, what time did it start then? Or was it
11:45 or something?
Yeah, 11:45 or something like that. And because of, you know, daylight saving, and they ran it in to it and still finished under twilight for it. But yeah, it goes back as the cars got quicker, the lap times have come down. If you have minimal, say, 5 safety cars, was it just a tad over 6 hours now?
Yeah, around 6 hours.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can understand it, but I mean, it's taken it away from a whole day.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because you probably know the backstory, but it's all just aimed at finishing for the 6 o'clock news or whatever, isn't it?
So Yeah.
So they're just trying to get it into that old prime time window or whatever as a lead in, which, yeah. I mean,
that's just sport these days.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's just all part of where it's headed. To try and work with the broadcaster. So, yeah, it's probably not that controversial. It's just the way it is.
All right, have we got a 2022 winner?
Well, I think off current form this year, Car 97 with Gisbergen and Tander is probably going in as a red-hot favourite for it. So, off form, I think they're the favourites to win, I think.
Well, I reckon there's only 5 cars that, if it's a normal race, and unless someone lands on a setup that smiles better than anyone else, that, you know, they come from the clouds. There's only really probably 5 cars that stand a chance of really winning, and that'd be the 2 Shell cars, the 97 Red Bull car, Mostert and Coulthard, and the number 6 Monster car, maybe Feeney and Win Cup. Oh, I'm gonna go the Davison brothers, number 17.
Ooh, statement.
Ooh, Alex Davison. I like him as a driver. I am going to go. Oh, Matty Campbell's in there, and I do like him, but I won't. Yeah, I reckon Luke's shout of the Davisons is because the other one, obviously, Coulthard as well, jumping in, he'll be pretty strong. But I'm going to go Will Brown and Jack Perkins.
They're one that could just chance on a good setup and then be at the front.
Oh, mate, it's got to be the 97. Got to be the 97. Or the Mostert car, because they were rockets last year.
Pick one.
97.
Oh, also, we've got two nominations for the Davison brothers. And oh, no, you know, you went
Brown and Perkins. Brown,
yeah.
Brown.
But I respect your decision. I just don't want to go the same car.
Yeah.
But I guess that, to your point, Luke, there with the Davisons, like, Will Davison's had a pretty solid year. You know, arguably, Anton was tipped to be on average the quicker car or the more consistent challenging Van Gisbergen, but Will Davison's definitely held his own with the speed he's been putting in there, and arguably been in front of Anton for a majority of the year. So it will be interesting to see how that pans out.
I mean, and Anton's still going quite well, so I think they're the most likely to have 2 cars that can be right at the front. They're close enough that you've only got to get it right on the day. And
well, you got to be there for the final pit stop, don't you? Or the buy your ticket to the final portion of the race, as they say.
Used to be buy your ticket to the final hour, but now it's buy your tickets to sort of the last 40 minutes, I think.
Five laps. Yes,
given the last pit stop's usually in the early 140s.
Yeah.
Maybe the best sweepstake to have is one will be the first safety car and one will be the last safety car.
Lap two for the first, and I reckon lap 151 for the last.
What about you, Daniel?
147 for the last and 52 for the first.
Yeah, we're all in the same ballpark for the end. I'm gonna have to go different. I'll say lap one.
Ooh.
And I'm just gonna go on a hope. Lap 98.
Well, that's a long green flag run.
Well, that's about where we'll leave our discussion on the Australian 1000 Classic for 2022. Jump onto our Facebook page and have a look at the photos and things like that that we put up on the Facebook page, and also on Instagram, and we're also on Twitter. And we'll see you soon on the next podcast. Thank you for listening.